All right, turning now to the confession. Well, we're not to the confession yet, as you can see. We're working on the history behind it, an important history. Now, today, we are going to address the subject of Baptists. Where do they come from? And we're going to have to address that because in 1644, there was a confession called the First Confession. It was written by seven Baptist churches, and in parentheses it says, which are commonly called Anabaptists. And they're writing publicly to say, we're not Anabaptists, this is what we believe. And I want us to understand that it's a contemporary issue for the assembly, and the assembly does address them. But we need to understand the history of the Baptist movement so we can understand the Presbyterian response to it then and how we ought to respond to it today. Now, charting the history of the Baptist movement can be tricky because there's no one single leader. You know, Calvinists look back to Calvin. Lutherans look back to Lutherans. Mennonites look back to Mennonites. But Baptists don't really have one single leader. But Methodists look to Wesley, for instance, as well. But the Baptists don't have that towering figure they can look to and say, we trace our roots from that person or whatever. And because of that, discovering the origins of the Baptist movement have been a little bit messy, partly because the Baptists messed it up themselves, because they constructed an alternate theory of their origins, which was used as an apologetic device during the frontier days to spread the Baptist church across the frontier in America. But that's been rejected. What I want to do is show you three common theories, three primary theories of Baptist origin, and then we're going to work our way into the rise of the general Baptist movement and then the rise of the particular Baptist movement. So let's cover some ground here. First of all, there is the theory of Baptist origins, which says that it goes straight back to the cross. This is called the successionist theory. It was proposed by a man named G.H. Orchard, and it was popularized in America by the so-called Landmarker Baptists. Landmarker Baptists' theology is summarized in the Cotton Grove Resolutions of 1555, including 5 points. One, religious societies not organized according to the New Testament model are not true churches. Two, such societies cannot be called gospel churches. Three, clergy of such societies cannot be recognized as gospel ministers. Four, pulpit exchanges by Baptists and non-Baptist ministers are not appropriate. Five, people associated with societies that were not true churches are not to be addressed as brothers. In other words, as Christians. Now, who are they talking about? You. Just remember that. This is what the Landmarkers Baptists taught. It was prevalent in America. The Landmarkers are not so prevalent anymore, but at one time it was very prevalent. And they traced their theory. They popularized this theory in America called the successionist theory. Now, the successionist theory traces the Baptist movement back to either John the Baptist, who's the original baptizer, or Jesus. Depending on how they want to frame the discussion, they'll refer to either one of them. They'll chase the theory from John the Baptist or Jesus through the apostles, and then they'll see a succession of true churches. Those who went through the Montanists, the Donatists, the Cathari, the Waldensians, the Anabaptists. What do all those groups hold in common? Well, throughout the history of the church, they've been condemned as false and sectarian churches. So it's kind of interesting, but basically what their argument was is the secessionists were trying to say, no, we're the real church, not the Roman Catholics, not the Anglicans, and not these Presbyterians. We are the real church. It was an apologetic tool, and it was developed basically whole cloth out of fiction. There is no historical basis for their argument, period. They would simply say that the Anabaptists were just one more of those sectarian groups which exemplified Baptist principles. This theory is almost universally rejected by Baptist historians and scholars today. Secondly, you have the Anabaptist spiritual kinship theory. This is basically the view that Baptists' origins owe their movement to, or their origins to, the Anabaptists, the continental Anabaptists of the 16th century. They said the Anabaptists at least got things right, like believers' baptism only, a regenerate church membership, and so forth. And this particular theory says the Anabaptists basically of the 16th century the resuscitation or revival of the true church, which disappeared with the rise of Constantinianism in the 4th century. Remember, Constantine is the Roman emperor, and he legalizes Christianity, the Roman Empire. They say that's the end of the church right there. And there's a big hiccup or yawn from the 4th century to the 16th century and the rise of the Anabaptist movement. Basically, there's no church except for some sectarian groups here or there, but generally the church is just gone. And it's revived in the 16th century by the Anabaptists. So the Baptists say, yes, we were influenced by them. Remember, we're talking about Baptists. We're talking about a British movement, a movement in England. And they're saying, yeah, we trace our origins to these Anabaptists who restored the true church. And they say that they basically the Anabaptists generated or produced the first Baptist church in England in 1609. Prominent Baptist historian Scott Culpepper says there's no doubt interaction did occur between the early founders of the Baptist tradition, both general and particular, and some Anabaptist groups, particularly Mennonite groups, living in the Dutch Republic. Although he says it's debatable how much influence they had. So here's a reputable Baptist scholar saying, yes, this model is historically verifiable and correct. There is an influence there upon general Baptists and even particular Baptists in England. Now, why is it important to talk about? Well, because Baptists denied their relationship to Anabaptists all the way up into the 18th century. During the 17th century, they resented it when the Presbyterians called them Anabaptists. And so you find a lot of them denouncing any claims or associations with Anabaptists at all. And they persistently did this until the 18th century when they finally said, yeah, where it became more popular. And now today, there is a resuscitation of this association, especially in Southern Baptist circles where they're wary of the new Calvinist movement within Southern Baptist circles. They say that these people they're acting contrary to the origins of the Baptist movement, which are not in Calvinism, but in Anabaptism. So it is a live subject today in scholarly circles and in just basic popular literature as well. Then there's a third theory, which says, no, we're not from Anabaptism, we're from English separatism. They will argue our influences, our origins, our roots, our theology comes out of the separatist movement in England. Now, what's the separatist movement? The separatist movement is that group of Puritans in the Church of England under the Elizabethan settlement from 1559 until her death who begin to agitate for change within the church. But they get tired of it. They say it's not moving fast enough. The church is not getting pure enough. We must separate and become our own church. And generally that means congregationalism. That means independence. And that means that you have the liberty to choose whatever doctrines you're going to believe in. Remember, in 16th century England, you had no right as a citizen of the empire to decide what your theology was. You were whatever the establishment said you were, or you were a criminal, period. So the separatists don't want that. They want to separate from their own pure churches. Out of that spawned the Baptist movement. We'll come back to that point, but I'm just saying, here's your three primary options for the rise of the Baptist movement in England. Now, in order to tackle this cat, you have to say there's a difference between general Baptists and particular Baptists in terms of their origin. And you'll see why I say that in a moment. So let's start with the rise of the general Baptists. The general Baptists, I've already said, there's a connection, at least on that third there, between them and the separatist movement. And it's true enough that there is. The leading separatist in the 16th century probably was Robert Brown. And he wrote a very influential treatise entitled Treatise of Reformation Without Tarrying for Any. And it had a tremendous influence. And he called for these Puritan groups to come out of the Anglican Church. And they labeled these people Brownists. And the three leading ideas of the Brownists were the right of a church to join in a single covenant together. And that is, a group of people come together on their own, according to their own free will, and associate, and they make up their own covenant, which binds them together as their own particular distinct congregation from everybody else. Two, The congregation agrees who is their pastor, no one else. And three, they come up with their own order of worship. They're not going to be told how to worship by the acts of uniformity or the queen or the bishops or anybody. Each church gets to decide on its own how it's going to worship according to its own conscience. Now, here's what you need to know. This movement spawns what's called the so-called ancient church. It was a group of separatists in London, and they form their own church. And that's going to be important in a moment because you're going to see the Baptists have a relationship with them. Another figure that's important that sort of helps kick off the Baptist movement is a guy named Francis Johnson. He was trained at Cambridge, and he was given the duty by the bishop to burn copies of the material produced by this so-called ancient church movement. And he decided to save some copies for himself so he could just read them on his own instead of always burning them. Turns out he got persuaded of their position and joins the group. Together, he and these other leaders of that group migrate to the Netherlands in the early 17th century and carry the ancient church over there. And from there, it began to split into several congregations, and some of those end up coming to America. That's enough of the background. Now, let's pick up two key figures in the rise of the English Baptist movement, the general Baptist movement. Number one, John Smythe, or Smith. It's S-M-Y-T-H. Now, John Smythe was trained at Christ College, Cambridge. Now, you have to understand that Cambridge was a nursery for Puritanism. And so, originally, Smythe is a hardcore Puritan, Calvinist, Reformed guy. And he comes under the teaching of this Francis Johnson, who is going to be a leader in the Congregationalist Independent Movement. And so his theology starts to shift. And he becomes more moderate in his agreement to Puritanism and stuff and staying within the church. Eventually, as he starts to preach, he begins to change his views. From 1600 till maybe 1605-6, he publishes a couple of tracts which start to show signs that he believes in independence. By 1606, he joins what's called the Gainsborough Church. It was a separatist, independent group that split off from the Church of England. Now, they were harassed so thoroughly by King James and his goons that they split into two groups and then went to Holland. Now, who do they associate with when they get to Holland? Well, the ancient church group, Francis Johnson and those guys. However, it doesn't take very long before he has a fight, Smith does, with Francis Johnson, who was his old teacher. And where do you think they went after they left the ancient church? Well, they hung out with the Mennonites, who were Anabaptists. And they don't become formal members of the Mennonites yet, but they hang out with them. And this is when you really start to see Smythe's stated views change. He begins to write tracts about his new views. His views on worship change. He says worship should be from the heart, and it shouldn't be so rigid and controlled by prescribed ceremonies and stuff like that. He also was against form prayers and believed that prayers had to be spontaneous and under the direction of the Holy Spirit. He also began to believe in congregational church government and believed that the church should be governed by pastors and deacons, which is a common Baptist model of church government, even now in the Southern Baptist Convention. Then he rejects infant baptism. In 1609, he wrote a treatise called The Character of the Beast, where he identifies baptism as a mark of the beast, infant baptism as a mark of the beast, and says that infant baptisms are false, they're not real baptism. And he says churches that baptized infants were not legitimate churches themselves, because they were made up of children of believers as well as believers. So, One of his reasons for rejecting infant baptism, he said, infants are born without original sin, so they don't need baptism anyway. So you can see his theology is just unraveling. He decides at this point that because he and everybody he knows has been baptized as an infant, that they're all unbaptized and they're not even a church. That's what he deduced from his theology. We're not even a church. So he disbands the church and then baptizes himself. He then baptizes his buddy, Thomas Helwys, and together they baptize everybody in the group by pouring. Now, that's interesting because in the Anglican Church prior to this, they sprinkled. Where did he get the theology of pouring? Well, he got it from the Anabaptists. He was hanging out with the Mennonite Anabaptists there. I believe it was in Amsterdam where he was. Let me check this real quick. Amsterdam. So this particular group of Anabaptists there poured. So you can tell that's a direct link. This idea of pouring is a departure from the form. So now you have to pour in order to have a real baptism. You have to be an adult. Now, what's going to happen to somebody who decides they need to be baptized again because their first baptism wasn't real? It was administered by an Anglican pastor as an infant by sprinkling. It's not a real baptism, so he has to have his own real baptism. He's not a part of the Mennonite church, so he can't have them baptize him. So he baptizes himself, but then he begins to realize that that's invalid, because what standing does he have to baptize himself? He's not standing in a succession of true pastors before him, and somebody before him administered baptism to himself, and therefore carrying on a succession of true relationship to apostolic teaching. So he renounces his baptism and goes to the Mennonites and asks them to baptize him. This is when he starts to say that the only way you can have a real baptism is if you have it associated with somebody who's already been baptized in the true way. But that problem, the problem with that is it only pushes back the problem of succession in the 16th century. You still have to account for who in the 16th century was properly baptized when you think that the church ended with the rise of Constantine well over 1,000 years before that. So now you're just, no one's baptized anywhere. And it causes a rift in that church. Some follow him, some follow Helwys. Smythe wants them to join the Mennonite church, and Helwys says no. In the meantime, Helwys and his disciples got together and excommunicated Smythe and his people. So it's a huge mess. At this point, the Waterlander Mennonites, a local Baptist communion, Anabaptist communion, is approached by Smythe. He wants him to join. They don't allow him to join right away because they've already seen he's a troublemaker and he's changing his views all the time. So they're wary of him. It's not till he dies that the Mennonites take his followers, disciples, into their church. And so he dies in 1612 and they bring his group into their fellowship. In the meantime, Helwys says, I've had enough of this. Let's go back. He goes back to England. And there, Helwys and his followers, those ones who were left over that had been baptized by himself and Smythe, start the first General Baptist Church in England in 1612. Now, their theology is not Calvinistic. This is why they're called general. They are Arminians now. They believe in a general atonement, not a specific atonement. They're real shaky on stuff like total depravity, and they don't believe in election. They're radical free willers. And they also have this peculiar characteristic. They believe that there should be no established church. They also believe that each person ought to be able to turn their own religion by themselves. They don't believe that there should be any public persecution or mandate to be a part of any particular church. You should just be free to choose your religion. In fact, Helwys went so far as to say that that it didn't matter what you were, you had the right to believe it and to practice it. He says whether you are a Turk, whether you are Catholic, whether you are anything, basically, he says you are free to be whatever your conscience leads you to accept. Now, this did not win him any friends in England, because even the Anglicans rejected that. There is to be an established church, and you're to toe the line and be that. And so what you're seeing in this radicalism, this idea that, you get to choose whatever religion you want to be, heretic, Turk, Jew, anything, it savors of Anabaptism, of the continent. So here you have a very clear connection in the theology of not only baptism and its mode, particular mode of pouring, one mode that was followed, but also the theology of church-state relation. These are all defining marks of Anabaptism, and he's laying his cards out on the table and saying, this is what we are. So it's true that he comes out of, Helwys comes out of the separatist movement, which has its roots in the Anglican Church, but his theology is not there. Separatists were nowhere near this. Your general separatist was nowhere near this idea of a radical, free religious experience, and they weren't all rejecting infant baptism, things like this. So it would be fair to say there's a tremendous influence, there's a significant influence of Anabaptism on Helwys and also Smyth. These are the founders of the General Baptist Church in England, so you need to see, first of all, that the General Baptist movement really has its roots in two streams, but probably a predominant influence by Anabaptism. So to call them Anabaptists is fair. Just according to the historical record, it is fair to regard them as such, even if they don't like that name or that association. There are a lot of scholars who look at the church-state ideas of both Smyth and Helwys, and they say there's no other source for their views intellectually than the Anabaptist movement. So I think it's fair for us to conclude here, very strong influences of Anabaptism. And William Estep, who happens to be kind of a leader of this historical line of research, who accepts the Anabaptist relationship, he says, the telltale piece of evidence supporting the relationship of Baptists and Mennonites is the adoption of believers' baptism by pouring. He said, there's no other source for this. Now, that brings us to the particular Baptists. And what's interesting here is that particular Baptists go out of their way to make sure that no one can hang an association on them, of association with Anabaptists. Then they didn't like it, and today they don't like it. So what we have to do is look at the historical background and say, what are their origins? Are they different? We should be fair with the evidence. I don't think we should have to be afraid of the evidence. Let's just look at it. So we can say that the beginnings of the particular Baptist movement have their origins in a man named Henry Jacobs. Henry Jacobs was a signer on that millenary petition that we referred to last week that was presented to James as he was heading from Scotland to England. It was signed by over 1,000 British clergymen who were petitioning James for change in the British church. Part of that had to do with the debates that had arisen between the Puritans and the more moderate Anglicans and so forth. But everybody realized that the settlement, the Elizabethan settlement, wasn't so settled. It was shaky. There were things that needed to be addressed. So he is an original signer. He also wrote a treatise about his ideas on what things need to be changed. It's called Reasons Taken Out of God's Word and the Best Human Testimonies Providing a Necessity for Reforming Our Churches in England. In his humble publication, here's what he says, that people ought to be able to assemble together somewhere publicly to the service and worship of God, to use and enjoy peaceable among ourselves alone the whole exercise of God's worship and of church government by a pastor, elder, and deacons in our several assemblies without any tradition of men whatsoever, according to the specification of God's written word and no otherwise, and we shall also afterward keep brotherly communion with the rest of our English churches as they are now established. Basically, What he's arguing here, Jacobs is arguing, is, look, I want to have an independent church. I want to have it ruled how I think a church ought to be governed, pastor, elder, and deacons, no bishops in this business. And he says, but we're going to be really nice to people. We don't want there to be hostility and conflict between us and our Anglican brothers. We're going to call them brothers. We're just going to say, we have a different view. See, he's appealing for tolerance for his separatist ideas. He hasn't yet separated, but he's appealing for tolerance. Well, that's not received very well. And he's thrown in jail. Then he's exiled from England. And finally, in 1616, he's allowed back into England. As soon as he gets back, he forms a separatist congregation. It is called the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church. The Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church, or shorthand JLJ Church. Now, why is it called that? It's just named after the last names of the various pastors they had from 1616 forward. Jacobs was the first pastor. He pastored just for a handful of years, and then he left because he was being persecuted, and he went to Virginia to set up a church there, and he died. Then John Lathrop became the pastor. He pastored from 1625 to 1634. At the end of his pastorate, there was a church split in 1633. Mark that. The only record we have of the goings-on is a writing called the Kiffin Manuscript, which records the minutes of the church meetings, and it's really not all that complete or thorough, but here's what it says. This was what the church split was about in 1633. He said, Mr. Eaton, with some others receiving a further baptism, left, and they formed their own church. We don't know what that church was. We just know it had something to do with some sort of a baptism. Then, by 1638, under the pastor Jesse, another group splits from the church. And this group that splits under a guy named Spilsbury begin to practice believers' baptism by 1641. So the particular Baptist origins are somewhere out of this JLJ church in the 1630s, and it's hard to nail down when they start to change, but clearly by 1641, this has become an identifying mark of this congregation, is that they practice believers' baptism and baptism by immersion. Mark that. Very important. They begin to practice baptism by immersion, and when they produce their first confession in 1644, called the First London Confession, they expressly state that the true and only form of baptism is baptism by immersion. That is new. Okay? Now, how do they come to this position? They supposedly maintain their Calvinist views on limited atonement and things of this nature, but their views of the church and its government radically change. They're separatists. They don't want to be connected to state church in any way, although they don't want there to be hostilities and so forth. But they want to change the meaning of baptism, the meaning of church membership, and so forth. Now, you need to think about this and remember this name, Richard Blunt. Richard Blunt. He began to view baptism's meaning through Colossians 2:12 and Romans 6:4. This is the first time that you find this kind of association between viewing baptism through those texts and the insistence upon baptism by immersion. Why does Blunt hold this? Details are sketchy, but one thing is clear. He speaks Dutch. So it could be that he's been reading Dutch literature, Dutch Anabaptist literature on this. The church in Jesse decides to send him over to Holland to a sect called the Rijnsburg sect. The Rijnsburg sect. To learn more about its baptism and so forth. So they go over there. Blunt got baptized by immersion. So now he's truly baptized. He comes back to England after hanging out with this Anabaptist sect, and then he baptizes his church, and that becomes the first particular Baptist church in England, the Jesse Church. And then their theology of baptism begins to spread around. Now, the thing about this Rheinsberg sect is that it included both Calvinists and so-called Calvinists and Mennonite Anabaptists. So what conclusions can we draw from the historical evidence now? Well, Culpepper says, and this is a Baptist historian, he says the particular Baptists adopted the practice of immersion in imitation of Anabaptist example on the continent. The only church that did it was the Rheinsberg Church. So you have there's no other connection. There's no other antecedent for this. And they also sent Blunt there to develop the theology of baptism by immersion as the form. So to draw the conclusion that a particular Baptist historian, Bellier, draws, that we can't figure out if there's any definite influence is perplexing. Of course there's definite influence. These are the only people who are doing it. But it seems to be a little bit more direct than that. Stausen makes a very compelling argument for the direct influence of Mennonite theology on the particular Baptists through Menno Simons' foundation book. And Stausen said there's four particular Baptist beliefs that have find no other origin or explanation than in Menno's foundation book. Number one, recipients of baptism as professed believers. That's a key phrase that's commonly used by this group. Professed believers. That verbiage savors of Menno Simons' foundation book. Two, baptism is a participation in Christ, signifies participation in Christ's death, burial, and resurrection. The form of baptism as immersion, and then appealing to Romans 6:4. All of these echo the Mennonite foundation book. You can't find these themes anywhere else. So Stausen says these are very strong links to this Rheinsberg group of people in Holland where they sent Blunt. Now, how did the Presbyterians respond to this? These group of seven churches by 1644, as a response to the Westminster Assembly, published their first confession, and the Presbyterians respond to them. And here's what they do. Number one, the Presbyterians say in Westminster Confession 28:5, it's a great sin to neglect baptism. Well, who are they talking to? People who just refuse to get baptized somehow? No. They're talking to people who don't baptize children of believers. 25:2 responds to this movement by saying that the true church, the true Catholic visible church, consists of believers and their children. And paragraph 3 says, unto this church, the ministry, oracles, and ordinances of God are given for the gathering and perfecting of the saints. So they're saying these people are claiming to be a church. They're not a church. They're responding to the particular Baptists. They're saying, for them to call us a false church, to deny our baptism, to have only this pure regenerate church membership and all this stuff, they have defined themselves outside of the visible church. So that's their response. They say they're not duly constituted, and they unambiguously rejected Anabaptism, that is rebaptism, and they tied. Particular Baptists and general Baptists together to Anabaptists. They didn't distinguish between them. There's all kinds of verbiage from the Presbyterians that proves that from that day. I see no reason to change. If you've freely chosen to be a Baptist, just acknowledge that's your history. We can debate the meaning of it all, but just admit it. Yes, there's a separatist influence. I'm not denying that. They come out of separatism. We cannot deny that. But their theology at so many places savors of a theology of Anabaptism. It borrows its verbiage, its patterns, its forms. There's just no way to deny it, that it is also Anabaptist. So I would argue that probably the most correct way of seeing the origins of these churches is a combination approach. They wouldn't have probably arisen in England, apart from the separatist movement, but they also would not have had the theology they did without Anabaptism. The difference between the particular Baptists and the general Baptists is slight when it comes to the issue of church and state. The particular Baptists want there to be room for differences of opinion, different churches, different kinds of churches, different kinds of worship, different kinds of government, but they still want to maintain that there should be some sort of a Christian magistrate who enforces a general Christianity. General Baptists reject that entirely. And you're going to find that when they come to America, the Baptist view of the magistrate wins. And we in America have disestablished church, and not only disestablished church, we have a government that is secular because of the Baptist influence was so profound eventually on America that we rejected the concept of the Christian magistrate. Okay, we're done there. I'll ask if you have any questions on the origins of the Baptist movement or 1 Samuel 18.